Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm Distinguished Research Fellow at the Institute. And today I'm joined by Katya Yefimova, who's Senior Research Fellow at the OIS and author of the paper, The 10E Regulation Allowing a Role for Decarbonised Gas, that was published by the Institute in early August. And we're also joined by Alex Barnes, who's Visiting Research Fellow at the Institute, and he published his paper, The Challenges and Prospects for Carbon Pricing in Europe, that was published in May 2022. Now, in this ever-changing market, I would like to timestamp this podcast recording, which we're doing on the morning of Wednesday, the 31st of August, 2022. Katya and Alex, welcome back to the OIS podcast series.
Morning, David. Morning, Alex. Good to be here.
Good morning. Good to see you, Bert.
Okay, well, Katya, can I perhaps start with you? What was the purpose of the original 10E regulation, and why was the revised regulation deemed necessary?
There was the original 10E regulation adopted in 2013, and the main purpose of it back then was to establish a regulatory framework for cross-border infrastructure inside the EU, and it established a Project of Common Interest, PCI, status for projects which would allow for faster permitting and also would make such projects eligible for EU funding. So the original idea was that such framework was to enable largely to develop new infrastructure in Central and Eastern Europe, particularly additional LNG terminals and interconnections that would allow those countries in that region to have access to additional supply sources, allowing for better diversification. And because many of those projects effectively lacked any commercial rationale, so they would not have built had they been purely commercial endeavours, that making those projects eligible for EU financial assistance really allow those projects to go ahead and to improve security of supply situation for those countries. So effectively, in short, security of supply concerns were the main reason why this original regulation was put in place. What this regulation did not focus on very much is sustainability criteria, and although those projects that were awarded PCI status, they did not necessarily have to meet sustainability criterion, was just one of the criteria they could be considered for, but that criteria was not mandatory. That has changed with the new regulation.
So Katya, what are the main findings from your paper, and how are they reflected in the main provisions of the revised 10E regulations?
So the main finding, I would say that the final 10E regulation, the revised regulation, enables and supports what is called hybrid decarbonisation, which would allow renewable hydrogen to be maximised within the system, but also would allow low-carbon hydrogen to play a role, which in turn would also allow the renewable hydrogen to be phased in more quickly. And on balance, that would help to achieve European Union's greenhouse gas emissions reduction targets earlier. So and also what's important is that it's not just pure electrification that is supported and enabled, it's electrification and also allowing gases, decarbonized gases, to play a role for optimal effect. If we talk about main provisions of the paper, there are several highlights, there are several important contributions that the regulation has made. And if I mentioned a few of them, the most important probably that it has removed gas corridors, the projects from which would be eligible for PCI status under the old regulation, but it instead added hydrogen and electrolyzer corridors, It added offshore grids, smart gas grids, etc. Why it's important? It's important because it facilitates the access of renewable and low carbon gases to the system through new power lines in terms of transporting renewable electricity produced onshore and offshore and then used to produce hydrogen, and also through new hydrogen pipelines and repurposed gas pipelines, of which there are many, obviously, with a view of transporting hydrogen. The key bit, really, of the revised regulation as far as gas infrastructure is concerned is that the regulation allowed for repurposing existing gas networks to transport hydrogen to be eligible for that status and therefore for financial assistance until the end of 2027. So that provides a transition period. It also ensured that projects that associated with such repurposing will be allowed to transport also blends of methane and hydrogen until the end of 2029. So it's effectively nearly a 10-year period. Why it's significant? It's significant because the eventually emerging hydrogen backbone is supposed to have a significant chunk, more than I think, two-thirds of it, based on repurposed gas pipelines. What's important is that the final regulation has that provision for repurposing, and whereas the original European Commission proposal didn't have it. So it's actually the result of joint work of the Commission, European Council, and the Parliament. And maybe to note another very important thing here is that what the revised regulation has also accomplished, it has made carbon dioxide, CO2 transport and storage facilities eligible for PCI status. Again, why it's important, because carbon capture and storage would be key element for low carbon hydrogen production if such projects happen, in addition to enabling industrial capture of CO2. And maybe just one more to mention, because it's also important, it has established a dedicated procedure for offshore grid planning on a significant scale, which includes both offshore electricity grid development, which would support offshore production of renewable electricity, but also offshore hydrogen grid development, which would support offshore production of renewable hydrogen. And those projects, those two categories, would be also eligible for PCI status. And last but not least, it has made sustainability a mandatory criterion against which all projects would have to be assessed, those projects that want to have a PCI status.
Well, Katja, thank you very much for that. You know, perhaps I'll now turn to Alex, if I may, and kind of, you know, ask you, you know, what is the difference between TENI regulation's role in the past and its role in the future?
Well, I think has been hinted at by the complexity of what Katja has outlined just now is that in the past, the TENI regulation, it had clarity of purpose. It was basically filling in the gaps. And in a gas context, this was filling in the gaps in terms of enabling gas to flow from west to east or from south to north, for example, so that in the event of supply disruptions, parts of Europe that previously would have been cut off weren't. And it's been very successful in doing that. So, for example, Finland is now connected to the rest of the network. Although the connection between Lithuania and Poland has been delayed, that's going to be there so that gas can flow freely around the market. And that has two advantages. One, it means that the market works better. You actually have a proper European single market. And also from a security of supply perspective, if you get major disruption in supplies, for example, from Russia, the system is much more robust than it would have been in the past. And I think we should actually, you know, given the current circumstances, that is very significant indeed. The problem with the TENI as it is now, they've tied themselves up in knots on certain bits because what they want to do is help lay the foundations for decarbonisation. but they've got stuck in all sorts of debates as should it allow repurposing of networks for hydrogen? What type of hydrogen should they allow? This is all explained in Katya's paper. There's been a lot of intense debate about should it allow renewable hydrogen or low carbon hydrogen. And frankly speaking, this is all a bit of a nonsense from an infrastructure point of view, because a pipeline carries hydrogen. It doesn't really know whether it's blue or green hydrogen. And actually, what you need to do is make sure the networks are there. And indeed, the rules that determine what type of hydrogen flows are going to be determined elsewhere. So they seem to have tied themselves a bit in the knot. I think where it is really helpful and should be is Katya mentioned the offshore grids for electricity, because we're going to need a lot more renewable power. It's going to be helpful in terms of electricity networks generally, because we're going to be electrifying a lot more. On the gas side, it's a bit more difficult because there is a lack of clear understanding as to how the future low carbon gas market, and that includes hydrogen, biomethane, etc., will evolve. And what they've tried to do, I think, in some of this stuff is try and sort of set what the future will look like, but without a very clear idea of what it is. So they kind of fall between the two stools of central planning on the one hand and putting in place the enabling conditions for the market to develop in the future. And you can see that by, as I say, all these discussions as to what type of hydrogen to allow. That said, support for infrastructure, particularly on the electricity side, I think is going to be crucial to enable renewable energy in whatever form to get to where it, from where it is produced to where it is needed.
Well, thanks, Alex. So Katya, perhaps I can come back to you and ask, you know, about the kind of revised regulation. You know, does it provide a positive contribution towards a regulatory framework for the decarbonisation of EU gas infrastructure?
Yeah, I think overall, on balance, it does. It may not really form a fully fledged regulatory framework for doing so, but it certainly provides a positive contribution towards building such regulatory framework. And of course, 10-year regulation is only one of the pillars for doing so. Another pillar is hydrogen and renewable natural gases package, directive and regulation, which is still under development. But as far as infrastructure, particularly cross-border infrastructure, is concerned, 10E regulation does make a good contribution, again, because, first of all, because it allows for such a hybrid decarbonization with electrons and molecules, as we've just discussed. And it also provides instruments for developing both renewable and low-carbon hydrogen. Of course, the latter's role is now questionable. The role that low-carbon hydrogen will play is questionable for a number of reasons. So regulation, I'd say, provides more time, in a way, for the decarbonization of the EU natural gas infrastructure. I've mentioned that transition period within which projects associated with repurposing of natural gas pipelines to carry hydrogen is envisaged in this regulation, effectively 10 years. But also, at the same time, this revised regulation confirms that unless such projects for low-carbon hydrogen actually take place pretty much now, then and make significant progress before 2030, they're probably not likely to happen at all. And that is important, of course, because it will have an impact on the final configuration of the hydrogen network in Europe. And as Alex correctly said, for the network, it doesn't matter what the region of hydrogen is, whether this hydrogen is produced through electrolysis, renewable energy, so whether it's green hydrogen or whether it's hydrogen produced from fossil fuels such as gas through pyrolysis or methane cracking. So it doesn't matter. It's still hydrogen, and for the network, it doesn't matter what to take in. But depending on which projects happen and what scale, the topology of the resulting network will clearly differ. And of course, the environment for low carbon hydrogen has become a lot more difficult compared to the time when the 10E regulation was under development for a number of reasons. And you know, we can talk about these issues too. That's very high gas price at present. If that high gas price environment persists for a few years, then low carbon hydrogen is quite simply uncompetitive with renewable hydrogen. And if that investment doesn't take place now, and it's difficult to see how that investment might take place now given the price environment, then it probably will have missed the boat to have this positive contribution. And that in turn would have an impact on the topology of the hydrogen network. So to me, it's a significant irony that although the European Commission's view and its proposal for the revised regulation was always very much pro-renewable hydrogen, and it left next to nothing role for low-carbon hydrogen. But then with the input from European Council and the Parliament, the final regulation, the revised regulation, now includes provisions enabling low-carbon hydrogen. But now it's unclear whether those provisions will be used just because of objective external factors now, which came to play after regulation was finally agreed.
Well, Alex, can I perhaps come back to you, you know, and ask, you know, what are the key hurdles, therefore, still facing decarbonisation of gas and the development of hydrogen in the EU?
One of the biggest hurdles is supply. Now, Cash has just mentioned that, you know, blue hydrogen or low carbon hydrogen is facing challenges because of not just high gas prices, but actually scarcity of gas. On the renewable side, what the EU has said is that they want to have 20 million tons of hydrogen production by 2030. And this is in part a reaction to the current Russian supply crisis. They want to substitute away from that, and that has to be renewable hydrogen. But the problem is that needs a hell of a lot of electricity. The EU's own estimates say that they need about 500 terawatt hours of electricity to meet the 10 million tons of hydrogen that they expect to produce locally. Now, that makes various assumptions about load factors and stuff. That is, that's a significant proportion of about the 1,100, 1,200 terawatt hours of renewable electricity generation in the EU today. So you've got to find an extra 500 terawatt hours just for hydrogen, and you've got to find an extra, you know, X number of terawatt hours to meet increased electricity demand as we electrify. And you've got to find extra renewable power just to get rid of the coal and the natural gas that we already use in the power generation system. So that's one huge, huge hurdle. The other hurdle is that the EU is still stuck in debates as to what is renewable hydrogen and what is low carbon hydrogen. There's a delegated act that is being discussed. It's now several months late, should have come out at the end of last year, as to how you set the criteria for renewable electricity use in hydrogen production. But depending on how you set that definition, you could actually find that the carbon footprint of renewable hydrogen is equivalent to that of low carbon or blue hydrogen, which makes the whole debate as to whether you're putting blue hydrogen or green hydrogen in your pipelines completely pointless. So there's a mix of what I would call technical regulatory factors, of which the definition is one, and then just the sheer practical factors of you've got to build an awful lot more renewable generation. And as Ursula von der Leyen said a few weeks ago, the current permitting time for renewable generation, wind generation, is about 9 years. So go figure, as they say.
Yeah, even though, of course, some of the fast regulatory approvals since March's invasion of Ukraine in European countries might speed up some of that timetable. You never know. Katja, can I come back to you? Because you mentioned earlier that the current high prices in Europe are having an impact on the development of low-carbon hydrogen in Europe. So I wondered, you know, do you think that the energy crisis is likely to play an important role in European energy transition?
Oh, that's for sure. Yeah, that's for sure. That that crisis is going to reshape the energy scene in many ways. And I think it's impossible from where we stand to predict how exactly the final landscape will look like. So too many uncertainties. But what I think is clear that for low carbon hydrogen, which had already faced an uphill battle, we wanted to develop on scale. In Europe, it has just become more difficult. So it has a triple challenge, if you like. So natural gas now, politically unpopular and expensive in Europe. Second thing, there are too few carbon capture and storage projects so far have made significant progress. And third is that, again, the EU's unequivocal political preference for renewable hydrogen. So these three factors will make it harder for low carbon hydrogen to develop, unsurprisingly, in a way which is a pity, because if it were able to develop on scale, it would have effectively prepared the ground and prepared the infrastructure for higher intake of renewable hydrogen when it becomes available. As Alex just said, it's also years away before renewable hydrogen will become available in sufficient volumes. So low carbon hydrogen could just go first and prepare the way for renewable hydrogen, allowing it to be phased in more quickly. And as I said earlier in the podcast, that was actually the main added value of this revised NE regulation, that it allowed room for both. It's going to be a lot more difficult to harvest that, if at all. That's not to say that no low carbon hydrogen project will happen in Europe. For example, you know, if you ask me to kind of give examples, probably those projects that have experienced significant government support, such as in Norway, I would say most likely would go ahead. But it's more difficult to say with any certainty whether that would be the case for other countries. And that's all the legacy also of the current crisis, for sure.
Well, Alex Kacha, you know, over the past 20 minutes or so, you know, we've discussed a lot of issues. And as you know, I always like to end by asking a forward-looking question. So, Kacha, can I perhaps come to you first? You know, the European Commission's RE Power EU plan envisages construction of additional gas infrastructure, allowing to bring non-Russian gas in. So, now what is the role for TEN-E regulation in this process?
Hey, David, that's a very good question, because it's really unclear what role, if any, the TEN-E regulation is going to play in any of this. Because as we discussed, TEN-E regulation provides a very elaborate framework for developing particularly cross-border gas infrastructure, and so will do the decarbonized natural gases and hydrogen package when it becomes available. They envisage very detailed, complex procedures for developing gas infrastructure. So you have national plans, you have the EU 10-year network development plans. Projects are included on the basis of elaborate modeling scenarios. There is also, of course, methodology how to do so. There is cross-border cost allocation issues. So it's all very, very elaborate mechanism, very elaborate procedure, and it takes years to get the project off the ground and then get all the permits and then finally build the infrastructure. As you mentioned, Power EU envisages a number of additional gas infrastructure, both in terms of LNG terminals and interconnections within the EU. And also, if you look at individual member states' efforts, you see that they're also rushing to build their own LNG import terminals, both fixed and FSRUs. And it's not specified anywhere, as far as I can tell, on the basis of which regulatory procedures any of this is going to be built. And then we also see the timelines that much of this new infrastructure is supposed to be up and running within a year or a couple of years. So quite clearly, that can't really be done within the existing regulatory framework, within the existing structures. So we may end up in a situation that there is this very nice elaborate regulatory framework, and there is also projects which are being developed kind of outside of this framework. And that's a problem. Why? Because it will make it effectively impossible to ensure that all of these projects are taken together, actually function in a consistent and coordinated manner, and actually improve a situation, make said situation optimal. So that's, to me, a very big question mark.
I think it's a huge question mark, Katja. Our infrastructure projects, as I said earlier on, require a lot of regulation, which takes a lot of time. But Alex, perhaps I can kind of finish with you by asking, you know, what are the issues that will still need to be addressed in terms of infrastructure regulation for low carbon gases?
I think in terms of infrastructure regulation, it's who's going to pay for the infrastructure, on the basis that the existing gas regulations are all user pays, and there are enough customers so that even if demand for gas fluctuates over the years, you have enough customers to pay for it. You know, you might have to put charges up in year two to compensate for the fact less gas flowed in year one, but it basically is fairly stable. And of course, that was possible because when they were brought in, we already had a big, mature, stable gas market. With going forward for low carbon gases, the issue is, well, how much infrastructure are we going to need? And even with the optimistic scenario, so to speak, the hydrogen backbone is only 40,000 kilometers, whereas current gas transmission infrastructure is 200,000 kilometers. So you're going to face, on one hand, the issue of potential stranded assets on the natural gas side. And legislators are paranoid about stranded assets because they keep saying, oh, well, if you're going to invest in more stuff, it must be dual purpose for future hydrogen. That always seems a bit odd because you have to convert it, whether it's old or new. But anyway, you're going to have stranded assets because you can't just switch off the gas network one day and instantly go to the hydrogen the next, because people are going to switch over time, which means that even if the gas network isn't being used nearly as much as it is today, there may still be customers on it. And until they are ready to switch to alternative energy supplies, you have to keep that gas network going. On the hydrogen or the low carbon gases side, if the low carbon gases are biomethane, it's not a problem. You use the existing natural gas infrastructure. It's the same stuff. On hydrogen, the issue is, yes, you can convert existing infrastructure, but you have this kind of timing issue. In the early years, there aren't going to be many customers, but you don't necessarily build it, your network, just for one or two customers. You build it for what you expect in the future. And although there are some provisions in the proposed hydrogen and gas decarbonization package, it actually doesn't really explain how this is going to be sorted out. Partly for the very sensible reason, this is actually an issue for national regulators. And somehow they have to balance this of how you move from the swings of natural gas to the roundabouts of hydrogen, but without falling off in between. And that's going to be a real, real big issue. And it's going to involve money.
So Katja and Alex, thank you so much for your time today. I really enjoyed our conversation that builds on the messages from both your papers that were recently published by the Institute. I hope you've all enjoyed this and this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.